Correct. In layman's terms, what kind of drug was this? It was for hypertension, for patients who suffered from elevated blood pressure. Were there any unpleasant side effects? According to the mass tort lawyers, there were. Well, what about the FDA? It didn't yank the drug because the mass tort lawyers were upset, did it? David was holding another report, and he waved it slightly as he spoke. I guess not. I didn't ask you to guess, Doctor. You've seen this FDA report. Clarvex caused severe, even blinding migraine headaches in thousands of patients, did it not?
According to the FDA, yes.
Do you dispute the FDA's findings?
I do.
And you supervise the clinical trials of Clarvex?
My staff and I supervise the testing of all pharmaceuticals made by our company. I thought we had already established that.
My deepest apologies. How many separate clinical trials were conducted during the testing of Clarvex?
At least six.
And where did these take place?
The beating would not end until the cross-examination was over, so Ulander plunged ahead. Four in Africa, one in Romania, one in Paraguay.
In Africa, how many subjects were treated with Clarvex?
There were roughly 1,000 patients in each trial. Do you remember what country or countries?
Not precisely. Cameroon, Kenya, and perhaps Nigeria. I can't recall the fourth.
Were these four trials conducted simultaneously?
Generally speaking, yes, over a 12-month period in 2002 and 2003.
Isn't it true, Doctor, that you, and I mean you personally, knew almost immediately that there were significant problems with the drug?
What do you mean by almost immediately?
David walked to his pile, picked up a document, and addressed the court. Your Honor, I would like to admit into evidence this internal memo sent to Dr. Mark Ulander from a certain Varick technician by the name of Darlene Ainsworth, dated May 4th, 2002.
Let me see it, the judge said.
Nadine stood and said, Your Honor, we object on the grounds of relevance and lack of a proper predicate being laid.
Judge Seawright scanned the two-page memo. He looked at Dr. Ulander and said, Did you receive this, Doctor?
I did.
David jumped in to help.
Your Honor, this memo was leaked by a Varick whistleblower to the plaintiff's lawyers in the Clarvex litigation 2 years ago.
Its authenticity was established at that time. Dr. Ulander knows it well.
That's enough, Mr. Zink. It will be admitted.
Mr. Zink plowed on. The memo is dated May 4th, 2002, correct, Dr. Ulander?
Correct.
So, some 2 months after Varick began its clinical trials in Africa, this memo comes across your desk. Look at the second page, last paragraph. Would you please read that to the jury, Dr. Ulander?
The witness obviously didn't want to read anything, but he adjusted his glasses and began. Patients have been taking Clarvex for 6 weeks, 40 milligrams, twice daily.
72% showed decreased blood pressure, systolic and diastolic. Side effects are worrisome. Patients complain of dizziness, nausea, vomiting, and many, approximately 20%, suffer severe headaches so debilitating it is necessary to stop the drug.
After comparing notes with other med techs here in Nairobi, I strongly suggest that all trials be suspended for Clarvex.
Now, Dr. Ulander, were the trials suspended?
No, they were not.
Were there similar reports from the field?
Ulander sighed and looked at the defense table, helpless.
I have copies of the other reports, Dr. Ulander, if they might refresh your memory, David offered helpfully.
Yes, there were other reports, Ulander said.
And this technician, Darlene Ainsworth, is she still employed by Varick?
I don't think so.
Is that a yes or a no, Doctor?
No, she is not employed.
Isn't it true, Dr. Ulander, that she was terminated 1 month after sending you this memo about the horrors of Clarvex?
She wasn't terminated by me, but she was terminated by Varick, wasn't she?
Well, I'm not sure how she left the company. She may have resigned.
David again walked to his table and picked up a thick document. He looked at Judge Seawright and said, Judge, this is Dr. Ulander's deposition from the Clarvex litigation 2 years ago. May I use it to refresh his memory?
Just answer the question, the judge snapped angrily at the witness. Was this employee terminated by Varick 1 month after she sent you that memo?
Startled by the rebuke from his honor, Dr. Ulander's memory was instantly refreshed, and he said, Yes, she was.
Thank you, the judge said.
David looked at the jury as he spoke.
So, in spite of these warnings from the field, Varick pushed on and gained FDA approval in 2005, right, Dr. Ulander? The drug was approved in 2005. And once it was approved, Varick aggressively marketed the drug in this country, right, Dr. Ulander? I have nothing to do with marketing, but you are on the board, right? Right. Then all hell broke loose, complaining of severe migraines and other side effects. At least 8,000 Varick consumers filed lawsuits in 2005, right, Doctor? I don't have access to those numbers. Well, let's not nitpick here, Doctor. I'll try to wrap this up a bit quicker. Has your company gone to trial anywhere in this country to defend its drug Clairvex? Once. And Varick has settled over 25,000 lawsuits for the drug as of last week, right, Doctor? Nadine was back. Objection, Your Honor. Settlements in other cases are not relevant to this one. I think Mr. Zink has stepped over the line. I'll decide that, Ms. Karras. But your objection is sustained. Mr. Zink, no talk of other settlements. Thank you, Your Honor. Now, Dr. Ulander, do you recall a Varick drug called Ruval? Ulander sighed again and began to study his feet. David walked to his table to reshuffle his files and fetch another stack of memos extracted from Varick's dirty laundry. In short order, he established that, one, Ruval was supposed to alleviate migraine headaches, but it also dramatically increased blood pressure. Two, it had been tested on migraine sufferers in Africa and India. Three, Varick knew of its side effects but tried to bury this information. Four, damaging internal company memos were discovered by trial lawyers in the ensuing litigation. Five, the FDA had eventually recalled the drug. Six, Varick was still defending various class actions, and not a single case had gone to trial. At 1 p.m., David made the decision to quit. He had grilled Dr. Ulander unmercifully for almost 3 hours with no counterpunch from Ms. Karras, and he had scored enough points. The jury, at first amused by the dirt on Varick, now seemed ready to eat lunch, deliberate, and go home. "A quick lunch," the judge said. "Back here at 2 p.m. David found an empty corner of the cafe on the second floor of the building and was eating a sandwich and looking over his notes when he felt someone approach from behind. It was Taylor Barkley, a Rogan associate, one of the few David had met and occasionally nodded to across the courtroom. "Got a second?" he said as he slid into a chair. "Sure." "Nice cross. Nadine makes few mistakes, but that was a big one." "Thanks," David said, chewing. Barkley's eyes darted around as if they were swapping crucial secrets. "Have you come across a blogger who calls himself the Hung Juror?" David nodded, and Barkley continued. "Our tech guys are very good, and they've tracked him down. He's in the courtroom 3 rows behind you. Navy sweater, white shirt, 30 years old, balding, glasses, pretty nerdy looking. Name's Aaron Dientz. Used to work for a mid-range firm downtown, but got whacked in the recession. Now he blogs and tries to be important, can't seem to find a job." "Why are you telling me this?" "He has the right to blog. The courtroom is open to the public. Most of his stuff is harmless, but he took a shot at your wife. Me, I'd deck him. Just thought you'd want to know. See you around." And with that, Barkley eased away and was gone. At 2 p.m., Nadine Karras stood and announced, "Your Honor, the defense rests." This had been discussed in chambers and was no surprise. Judge Seawright wasted no time and said, "Mr. Zink, you may address the jury in closing statement." David had no desire to address the jury and ask for compassion for his client, Iris Klopek, but it would be extremely awkward for a lawyer who had tried a case from beginning to end to waive final argument. He stood at the podium and began by thanking the jurors for their service. Then he confessed that this was his first trial, and frankly, he had not planned on doing anything but research. However, events had conspired to thrust him into this arena, and he felt bad for not doing a better job. He held up a document and explained that it was the pretrial order, sort of an outline for the trial that both sides agree on long before the jury is selected. Of interest, on page 35, was a list of the experts for the defense. 27. All with the word doctor attached somewhere to their names. Thankfully, the defense did not call all 27, but they certainly hired and paid them. Why would any defendant need so many well-paid experts? Perhaps the defendant had something to hide. And why would the defendant need so many lawyers, David asked, waving an arm at the Rogan-Rothberg team. His client, Iris Klopek, could not afford such talent. The field was not level. The game was rigged. Only the jury could equalize things. He spoke less than 10 minutes and happily left the podium. As he walked back to the table, he glanced at the spectators and made eye contact with Aaron Dientz, the hung juror. David stared at him for a few seconds, then Dientz looked away. Nadine Karras argued for 30 minutes and managed to shift the attention back to Crayox and away from those other unpleasant tests Mr. Zink had talked about. She vigorously defended Varric and reminded the jurors of the many well-known and trusted drugs the company had given to the world, including Crayox, a drug that had survived the week nicely since the plaintiff had failed miserably to prove there was anything wrong with it. Yes, she and Varric may have 27 noted experts in their lineup, but that was beside the point. Much more important was the expert proof offered by the plaintiff, who filed the lawsuit and had the burden of building a case and had thoroughly failed to do so. David watched her performance with great admiration. She was smooth and skilled, and her trial experience was obvious from the way she moved around, spoke, chose her words effortlessly, looked at the jurors, smiled at them, and trusted them. From their faces, there was little doubt they trusted her, too. David waived his rebuttal argument. Judge Seawright went straight to the reading of the jury instructions, the most tedious segment of any trial. At 3:30, the jury was led from the courtroom to begin its deliberations. David wanted to get away, so he carried a large box of his documents to his SUV in the garage. As he was riding the elevator back up to the 23rd floor, his cell phone vibrated. The text message said, "The jury is ready." He smiled and whispered, "That didn't take long." When the courtroom was quiet, a bailiff brought in the jury. The foreman handed the written verdict to the clerk, who gave it to Judge Seawright, who said, "The verdict appears to be in order." It was returned to the foreman, who stood and read, "We, the jury, find for the defendant Varric Laboratories." There was no reaction from anyone in the courtroom. Judge Seawright went through his post-verdict rituals and released the jurors. David had no desire to hang around and suffer through the happy horseshit of "nice job, tough set of facts, better luck next time." As soon as the judge tapped his gavel and adjourned court, David lifted his heavy briefcase and dashed from the room. He beat the crowd and was hustling down the hall when he caught a glimpse of a familiar blue sweater entering a restroom. David followed, and once inside, he scanned the room and saw no one but Aaron Dientz. David washed his hands, waited, and when Dientz finished at the urinal, he turned and saw David. "You're the hung juror, right?" David said, and Dientz froze, unmasked. "So what?" Dientz said with a sneer. David cocked his arm and shot a right cross that landed perfectly on the fleshy left jaw of the hung juror, who was too stunned to react. He grunted as his jaw popped. David followed with a quick left hook that landed on the nose. "That's for the bimbo, you ass," David said as Dientz fell to the floor. David left the restroom and saw a crowd at the far end of the hall. He found the stairs and sprinted down to the main lobby. He dashed across the street to the garage and was safely locked in his SUV before he took a deep breath and said, "You idiot." After a circuitous route back to the office, David arrived late on Friday afternoon. To his surprise, Oscar was sitting at the table having a soft drink with Rochelle. He looked thin and pale, but he had a smile and said he was feeling okay. His doctor had cleared him to spend no more than 2 hours a day at the office, and he claimed he was eager to get back to work. David gave a highly condensed version of the trial. He mimicked the Russian accent of Dr. Borzov, and this drew laughter. All jokes were on Finley and Fig, after all, so why not laugh at themselves? When he described his frantic efforts to find Dr. Threadgill, they laughed some more. They could not believe that Helen had been drafted into service. When he described the faces of the jurors during Iris's video, Rochelle wiped her eyes with a tissue. "And in spite of my brilliant performance, the jury reached its verdict in only 17 minutes. When the humor was gone, they talked about Wally, their fallen comrade. They talked about the bills, the line of credit, their bleak future. Oscar suggested they forget about it until Monday morning. "We'll figure out something," he said. David and Rochelle were startled at how thoughtful and kind he had become. Perhaps the heart attack and surgery had softened him up and provided a glimpse of his own mortality. The old Oscar would have been cussing Fig and griping about the firm's imminent financial ruin, but the new one seemed oddly optimistic about their situation. After an hour of the most pleasant conversation David had experienced around the office, he said he needed to go. His paralegal was waiting with dinner and wanted to know about the trial. Chapter 47. Over the weekend, David putted around the house, ran errands for Helen, pushed Emma through the neighborhood in her stroller, washed and shined both vehicles, and kept an eye on the online buzz about the trial and Varick's great victory. There had been a small story in Saturday's Sun-Times and not a word of the Tribune. The online publications, though, were busy with the aftershocks. Varick's public relations machinery was in full swing, and the verdict was being described as a major vindication of Crayox. CEO Reuben Massey was quoted everywhere touting the drug, condemning the mass tort bar, promising to crush those ambulance chasers in any courtroom they dared to enter, praising the wisdom of the Chicago jurors, and clamoring for more laws to protect innocent corporations from such frivolous lawsuits. Jerry Alessandro's was unavailable for comment. Indeed, there were no comments from any of the lawyers suing Varick Labs. For the first time in recent history, the entire tort bar has gone silent, observed one reporter. The call came at 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. Dr. Biff Sandroni had received the samples of nasty teeth by FedEx on Friday morning, about the time David was grilling Dr. Yolander on the stand. Dr. Sandroni had promised to test the samples immediately. They're all the same, David. All coated with the same lead-based paint. Highly toxic. Your lawsuit is a cinch. Open and shut. The best I've ever seen. When can you finish the report? I'll email it tomorrow. Thanks, Biff. Good luck. An hour later, David and Helen loaded Emma into her car seat and set off for Waukegan. The purpose of the trip was to check on Wally, but there was the added benefit of having the baby finally go to sleep. After 4 days of sobriety, Wally looked rested and was eager to leave Harbor House. David recapped the trial, and not wanting to repeat himself and not entirely in the mood for humor, omitted the parts that Oscar and Rochelle had found so funny Friday afternoon. Wally apologized repeatedly until David asked him to stop. "It's over, Wally. We have to move on." They talked about ways to unload their Crayox clients and the problems this might create. It really didn't matter how complicated things became. Their decision was final. They were finished with Crayox and Varick. "I don't need to stay here any longer," Wally said. They were alone at the end of the hallway. Ellen had stayed behind in the car with the sleeping baby. "What does your counselor say?" "I'm getting tired of that guy." "Look, David, I fell off the wagon because of the pressure. That's all. I consider myself sober right now. I'm already counting the days. I'll jump back into AA and hope and pray I won't fall off again. Hear me, David, I don't like being a drunk. We got our work cut out for us, and I gotta stay sober." With his portion of the meter ticking at $500 a day, David wanted Wally out as soon as possible, but he was not convinced a 10-day detox would work. "I'll talk to the counselor. What's his name?" "Patrick Hale. He's really beating me up this time." "Maybe that's what you need, Wally." "Come on, David. Get me out of here. We've dug a hole for ourselves, and it's just you and me this time. I'm not so sure Oscar will be much help." Left unsaid was the fact that Oscar had been the great skeptic about Crayox and mass torts in general. The deep hole in which they now found themselves had been dug by Wallace T. Figg. They talked about Oscar for a while, his divorce, his health, his new girlfriend, who was not really that new, according to Wally, though David did not press for details. As he left, Wally pleaded again, "Get me out of here, David. We have too much work to do." David hugged him goodbye and left the visitor's room. The work, Wally kept referring to, was little more than the imposing task of getting rid of 400 or so dissatisfied clients, mopping up the remains of the Klopek trial, grappling with a lot of unpaid bills, and laboring away in a building now burdened with a $200,000 mortgage. In the past month, the firm's other clients had been neglected, many to the point of hiring other lawyers, and the daily inquiries from prospective clients had declined dramatically. David had thought of leaving, of opening his own shop, or looking at other smaller firms. If he walked away, he would, of course, take the Tuya Kang case with him. Oscar and Wally would never know about it. If the case eventually paid off, David could write a check to Finley and Figg for his share of the mortgage on the building. But these thoughts were bothersome. He had run away from one firm and never looked back. If he ran away from the second one, he would always have regrets. In reality, David knew he could not leave Finley and Figg with the two partners ailing and a swarm of unhappy clients and creditors pounding on the door. The phones rang constantly Monday morning. Rochelle answered a few times, then announced, "It's all those Crayox people asking about their cases." "Unplug it," David said, and the racket stopped. The old Oscar was making a comeback. He was in his office, door tightly closed, shoving paperwork around his desk. By 9 a.m., David had composed a letter to be mailed to the 400 or so clients who only thought they had a lawsuit. It read, "Dear Blank, last week our firm tried the first lawsuit against Varick Labs for its drug Crayox. The trial did not go as planned and was not successful. The jury ruled in favor of Varick. With all the evidence now presented, it is clear that additional litigation against the company would be ill-advised. For that reason, we are withdrawing as your counsel. Feel free to consult with another attorney. For what is worth, Varick presented convincing proof that Crayox does not damage the heart valves or any other part of the body. Sincerely, David Zink, attorney and counselor at law." When Rochelle's printer began spitting out the letters, David went upstairs to prepare for another fight in federal court, which, on that Monday morning, was the last place he wanted to go. He had a rough draft of a lawsuit to be filed against Sonesta Games, and a rough draft of a letter he planned to send to the company's chief in-house counsel. He polished and tweaked both as he waited on Sandroni's report. Varick stock opened at $42.50 on Monday morning, its highest value in over 2 years. David scanned the financial sites and blogs, and they were still buzzing with speculation about the future of Crayox litigation. Since David had no role in that future, he was losing interest fast. He searched the near-impenetrable website of Cook County, courts, criminal, warrants and affidavits, and found no record of a complaint for assault filed by one Aaron Dientz. On Saturday, the hung juror had blogged about the ending of the Klopek trial, but did not mention getting punched out in the men's restroom on the 23rd floor of the Dirksen Federal Building. Oscar had a friend, who worked in warrants and affidavits, and this friend was supposedly on the lookout for a filing by Dientz. "You really decked him?" Oscar had asked, with genuine admiration. "Yes, a stupid thing to do. Don't worry, it's just simple assault. I got friends." When Sandroni's report arrived, David read it carefully and almost salivated at its conclusion. "The levels of lead in the paint used in coating the nasty teeth toys are of toxic levels. Any child or person using this product in the exact manner in which it was designed to be used, to wit, insertion into the mouth, over the real teeth, would face the grave risks of ingesting quantities of lead-based paint." For good measure, Dr. Sandroni added, "In 30 years of testing products for sources of poisoning, primarily lead poisoning, I have never seen a product so grossly and negligently designed and produced." David copied the 6-page report and placed it in a binder with color photos of the original set of nasty teeth used by Tuya and photos of the samples David had purchased the week before. He added a copy of the lawsuit and a medical summary prepared by Tuya's doctors. In a pleasant but straightforward letter to Mr. Dylan Cott, chief in-house counsel for Sonesta Games, David offered to discuss the matter before filing suit. However, this offer was good for 14 days only. The family had suffered greatly, continued to suffer, and was entitled to immediate relief. When he left for lunch, he took the binder and shipped it to Sonesta Games by FedEx, overnight priority. No one else at the firm knew what he was doing. For contact information in the letter, he used his home address and cell phone. Oscar was leaving as David returned, and his chauffeur was a tiny little woman of dubious ethnicity. At first, David thought she was Thai, and she appeared more Hispanic. Regardless, she was pleasant to chat with on the front sidewalk. She was at least 20 years younger than Oscar, and during the brief conversation, David got the clear impression that the two had known each other for some time. Oscar, who looked quite frail after an easy morning at the office, slowly folded himself into the passenger seat of her little Honda, and away they went. "Who was that?" David asked Rochelle as he closed the front door.
"I just met her myself. Some weird name I didn't get either. She told me she's known Oscar for 3 years. Wally's skirt chasing is well known. I'm kind of surprised about Oscar. Are you?"
Rochelle smiled and said, "David, when it comes to love and sex, nothing surprises me." She held out a pink phone message slip. "While we're on the subject, you might want to call this guy."
"Who is it?"
"Goodloe Stamm, Paula Finley's divorce lawyer."
"I don't know a thing about divorce law, Rochelle."
Rochelle gave an exaggerated look around the room, around the offices, and said,
"They're all gone. I guess you better learn fast."
Stan began with a sappy, "Too bad about the verdict, but I really wasn't surprised."
"Nor was I," David said tersely. "What can I do for you?"
"Well, first of all, how's Mr. Finley?"
"Oscar's fine. His heart attack was only 2 weeks ago today. He actually came to the office this morning for a few hours, and he's making steady progress. I suppose you're calling to ask about the Crayox litigation and hoping there might still be a chance of some fees coming our way. The answer, unfortunately for us, for our clients, and for Mrs. Finley as well, is that there is no prospect of making a dime off these cases. We're not going to appeal the Klopek verdict. We are in the process of notifying all of our Crayox clients that we are withdrawing as counsel. We hocked the office to finance the trial, which cost us about $180,000 in cash. The senior partner is recovering from a heart attack and bypass surgery. The junior partner has taken a leave of absence. The firm is now being run by me and one secretary who, by the way, knows a lot more about the law than I do. In case you're curious about Mr. Finley's assets, let me assure you that he has never been broker than he is right now.
As I understand his offer to your client, he is willing to give her the house, all the furnishings, her car, half the cash in the bank, which was less than $5,000, in return for a simple, uncontested divorce. He just wants out, Mr. Stamm. I suggest you and your client take this offer before he changes his mind.
Stamm digested this and finally said, "Well, I appreciate your candor."
"Good. Here's some more. On behalf of your felonious client, Justin Bardall, you filed a lawsuit against Oscar Finley for that unfortunate shooting incident. As I read the file, your client is headed back to prison for attempted arson. As I mentioned, Mr. Finley is quite broke. His insurance company is refusing coverage because it deems his actions intentional as opposed to negligent. So, with no insurance coverage and no personal assets, Mr. Finley is judgment-proof. You cannot squeeze a nickel out of him. Your lawsuit is worthless."
"What about the office building?"
"Heavily mortgaged."
"Look, Mr. Stamm, you cannot get a verdict because your client is a twice-convicted felon who was caught in the act of trying to commit a crime. Extremely lousy jury appeal. But if you got lucky and got a verdict, Mr. Finley would file for bankruptcy the next day. You can't touch him, you understand?"
"I get the picture."
"We have nothing, and we are hiding nothing. Please have a chat with Mrs. Finley and Mr. Bardall and explain this to them. I would love to close these files as soon as possible."
"Okay, okay. I'll see what I can do."
Chapter 48. A week passed with no word from Sonesta Games. David watched the calendar and the clock. He fought the urge to dream of a quick settlement, and he dreaded the idea of filing a lawsuit in federal court against a large corporation. That treacherous road had just been traveled. At times he felt like the old Wally, lost in dreams of easy money. The firm slowly returned to a routine that somewhat resembled the old days. Rochelle arrived at 7:30 each morning and enjoyed her quiet time with AC. David was next, then Wally, whose car had been towed during the drinking spree and was not damaged. Oscar rolled in around 10, delivered to the front door by his girlfriend, a charming lady who managed to impress even Rochelle. At some point each morning, Wally faced each of his colleagues and said, "Day 12 of sobriety, then day 13, and so on. He received congratulations and encouragement and was once again proud of himself. He found an AA meeting almost every night somewhere in the city. The phones were still ringing with calls from disgruntled Crayox clients, all of whom Rochelle routed to Wally and David. The ex-clients were generally subdued, even pitiful, as opposed to belligerent. They had been expecting money. What happened? The lawyers were apologetic and tended to blame things on some mysterious federal jury that had ruled in favor of the drug. The lawyers were also quick to point out that it had been proven in court that Crayox was safe. In other words, your lawsuit is gone, but your heart is much healthier than you thought. Similar conversations were being repeated across the country as dozens of high-flying lawyers backtracked from the drug. A lawyer in Phoenix filed a motion to dismiss four lawsuits involving clients allegedly killed by Crayox. His motion met a Rule 11 response straight from the Nadine Karras playbook. Varick Labs demanded sanctions for the filing of the frivolous cases and provided detailed billing and expense records to prove it had spent over $8 million defending the lawsuits.
With the mass tort lawyers in retreat, it soon became apparent that Varick was in hot pursuit. The wars over Rule 11 sanctions would rage for months. 10 days after the verdict, the FDA lifted its recall of Crayox, and Varick flooded the market. Reuben Massey would quickly restock his cash reserves, and his first priority was to pound away at the mass tort bar over its mistreatment of his beloved drug. 11 days after the verdict, and still no word from Aaron Dientz. The hung juror had taken a break from his blog without an explanation. David had two thoughts about a prosecution for simple assault. First, if Dientz filed charges, he would run the risk of blowing his cover. Like many bloggers, he relished his anonymity and the freedom it allowed to say virtually anything. The fact that David knew who he was and called him out right before he punched him had to be unsettling. If Dientz pressed charges, he would be forced to appear in court and admit to being the hung juror. If he was really out of work and looking for a job, his blogging might haunt him. In the past 2 years, he had said terrible things about judges, lawyers, and law firms. On the other hand, he had been on the receiving end of two solid punches. David had not felt bones breaking, but there had to be damage, if only temporary. Since Dientz was a lawyer, he would probably insist on getting his day in court and his revenge. David had yet to tell Helen about the assault. He knew she would react with disfavor and she would worry about an arrest and prosecution. His plan was to tell her only if Dientz filed charges. In other words, he would tell her later, maybe. Then he had another idea. There was only one Aaron Dientz in the phone book, and late one afternoon, David dialed his number. "Aaron Dientz, please," David said. "Speaking. Who is this?" "David Zink here, Mr. Dientz, and I'm calling to apologize for my actions after the jury's verdict. I was upset, angry, and I acted rashly." A pause, then, "You broke my jaw." At first, there was a flash of macho pride in the fact that he could throw a punch with such ferocity, but all bravado vanished when David thought about a civil lawsuit for personal injuries. "Again, I apologize, and I certainly did not intend to break anything or cause bodily harm." Dientz's next response was most revealing. He asked, "How did you learn my identity?" So he was afraid of being exposed. David fudged a little by saying, "I have a cousin who's a geek. Took him 24 hours. You shouldn't post at the same time each day. Sorry about the jaw. I'm willing to cover your medical expenses." He made this offer because he was compelled to, but he flinched at the thought of another outlay of cash. "Are you trying to offer a deal, Zink?" "Sure. I'll cover your medicals, and you agree not to press charges or pursue damages." "You're worried about an assault charge?" "Not really. If I have to defend myself for the assault, I'll make sure the judge sees some of your comments, and I doubt he'll be impressed." "Judges despise blogs like yours." Judge Seawright followed it daily and was furious, thought it might affect the case if any of the jurors stumbled across it. His clerks were trying to learn the identity of the hung juror. David was spinning this wild fiction on the fly, but it had a legitimate ring to it. "Have you told anyone?" Dientz asked. David couldn't tell if he was timid, scared, or just dealing with a broken jaw. "Not a soul. I lost my insurance when I lost my job. The medicals are $4,600 as of now. The wires are in for a month. After that, I don't know." "I made my offer," David said. "Do we have a deal?" A long pause, then, "Yes, I guess. There's one other thing, Mr. Dientz." "Okay, what is it?" "You called my wife a bimbo." "Yes, I shouldn't have done that. Your wife is very attractive." "She is, and she's a very smart lady." "My apologies." "And mine." Wally's first post-trial victory was the successful completion of Oscar's divorce settlement. With little in the way of assets and both parties desperately wanting out, the agreement was actually quite simple, if any legal document could ever be considered simple. When Oscar and Wally signed their names just below Paula Findlay and Goodloe Stamm, Oscar stared at the signatures for a long time and did not attempt to suppress a smile. Wally filed the agreement in circuit court, and an appearance date was set for mid-January. Oscar insisted on a celebratory bottle of champagne, non-alcoholic, of course, and the firm met at the table for an unofficial meeting late in the day. Since all four knew the score, day 15 of sobriety, Wally was toasted along with the newest bachelor on the block, Oscar Finley. It was Thursday, November 10th, and though the little boutique firm was facing a mountain of debt with few clients, they seemed determined to enjoy the moment. Wounded and humiliated, they were still standing and showing signs of life. Just as he drained his glass, David's cell phone vibrated. He excused himself and went upstairs. Dylan Cott introduced himself as the senior VP and chief counsel for Sonesta Games, a position he had held for many years. He was calling from the company's headquarters in San Jacinto, California. He thanked David for his letter, its tone and reasonableness, and assured him the package had been studied by the company's top brass, and, frankly, there was deep concern up there. He, too, was concerned and said, "We'd like to get together, Mr. Zink, face-to-face, and the purpose of the meeting would be to," David asked, "discuss ways to avoid litigation and to avoid negative publicity." "Certainly. We are a toy company, Mr. Zink. Our image is very important to us." "When and where?" "We have a distribution center and office in Des Plaines, your neck of the woods. Could you meet us there Monday morning?" "Yes, but only if you're serious about a settlement. If you plan to walk in with some low-ball scheme, then forget it. I'll take my chances with a jury." "Please, Mr. Zink, it's too early to start with the threats. I assure you we recognize the gravity of the situation. Sadly, we've been here before. I can explain it all on Monday." "Fair enough. Has a legal representative been appointed by the court for this child?" "Yes, his father." "Would it be possible to have both parents on hand Monday morning?" "I'm sure they can be there. Why?" "Carl Laporte, our CEO, would like to meet them, and on behalf of our company, offer an apology." Chapter 49. The facility was one in a long row of modern warehouses that covered acres and seemed to stretch endlessly west from Des Plaines and the Chicago suburbs. Thanks to his GPS, David found it with no trouble, and at 10 o'clock Monday morning, he escorted So and Luin Kang through the front door of a red brick office complex stuck to the side of a massive warehouse. They were immediately led through a hallway and into a conference room where coffee, pastries, and juice were offered. They declined. David's stomach was flipping and his nerves were on edge. The Kangs were thoroughly overwhelmed. Three well-dressed corporate types entered the room: Dylan Cott, chief counsel, Carl Laporte, CEO, and Wyatt Vitelli, chief financial officer. Rapid introductions were made, and then Carl Laporte asked everyone to have a seat and did his best to reduce the tension. More offers were made of coffee, juice, and pastries. "No, thanks." When it soon became apparent that the Kangs were too intimidated to converse, Laporte grew somber and said to the parents, "Well, first things first, I know you have a very sick boy, and he is not likely to improve much. I have a 4-year-old grandson, my only grandchild, and I cannot imagine what you are going through. On behalf of my company, Sonesta Games, I take full responsibility for what has happened to your son. We did not make the product, this nasty teeth toy, but we own the smaller company that did import it from China. Since it's our company, it is our responsibility. Any questions?" Luin and So shook their heads slowly. David watched in amazement. In a trial, these comments by Carl Laporte would be fair game. An apology by the company would be admissible into evidence and carry great weight with the jury. The fact that he was accepting responsibility and doing it without hesitation was important for two reasons. First, the company was sincere. And second, the case was not going to trial. The presence of the CEO, CFO, and top lawyer was a clear sign that they had brought their checkbook. Laporte continued, "Nothing I can say will bring back your little boy. All I can do is say I'm sorry and promise you that our company will do all that we can to help you." "Thank you," So said as Luin wiped her eyes. After a long pause during which Laporte watched their faces with great sympathy, he said, "Mr. Zink, I suggest the parents wait in another room down the hall while we discuss matters." "Agreed," David said. An assistant suddenly materialized and led the Kangs away. When the door was closed again, Laporte said, "A couple of suggestions. Let's take off our coats and try to relax. We could be here for some time. Any objection to using first names, Mr. Zink?" Not at all. Good. We're a California company, and our culture leans to the informal. All coats were removed and ties loosened. Carl continued, How would you like to proceed, David? You called the meeting. Right, so a little background might be helpful. First, as I'm sure you know, we're the third largest toy company in America, sales last year of just over $3 billion. Behind Mattel and Hasbro, David said politely. I've read all your annual reports and a ton of other stuff. I know your products, history, financials, key personnel, divisions, and long-term corporate strategy. I know who insures your company, but of course the limits of liability are not disclosed. I'm happy to sit here and chat as long as you guys would like to. I have nothing else planned for the day, and my clients have taken off from work. But to move things along, I suggest we get down to business. Carl smiled and looked at Dylan Cott and Wyatt Vitelli. Sure, we're all busy, Carl said. You've done your homework, David, so tell us what you have in mind. David slid across Exhibit 1 and began. This is a summary of brain damage verdicts over the past 10 years, kids only. Number one is a $12 million verdict in New Jersey last year for a 6-year-old who ingested lead by chewing on a plastic action figure. The case is on appeal. Look at number four, a $9 million verdict in Minnesota that was upheld on appeal last year. My father sits on the Minnesota Supreme Court and is fairly conservative when it comes to upholding large verdicts. He voted to affirm that one, as did the rest of the court. Unanimous. It was another lead poisoning case, a kid and his toy. Number seven involves a 9-year-old girl who nearly drowned when her foot got caught in the drain of a brand new swimming pool at a country club in Springfield, Illinois. Jury deliberated less than an hour and awarded the family $9 million. On page two, look at number 13. A 10-year-old boy was hit with a piece of metal flung from a commercial bush hog with no chain guards. Severe brain damage. The case was tried in federal court in Chicago, and the jury awarded $5 million in actual damages and $20 million in punitive damages. The punitive award was cut to $5 million on appeal. I don't need to go through every case, and I'm sure you guys are familiar with this territory. It should be obvious, David, that we would like to avoid a trial and jury. I understand, but my point is that this case has tremendous jury appeal. After the jurors spend 3 days looking at Tuya Kang strapped into his high chair, they might bring back a verdict larger than any of these. That potential should be factored into our negotiations. Got it. What is your demand? Carl asked. Well, a settlement should include several areas of compensation, some relatively easy to tally, others not so easy. Let's start with the financial burden on the family to care for the child. As of now, they're spending about $600 a month on food, medications, and diapers. Not much money, but a lot more than the family can afford. The boy needs a part-time nurse and a full-time rehab specialist to at least attempt to retrain muscles and reprogram the brain. What's his life expectancy? Asked Wyatt Vitelli. No one knows. It's a moving target. I didn't put it in my report because one doctor says a year or two, off the record, and another one says he could live to be an adult. I've talked to all the doctors, and no one thinks it's smart to predict how long he might live. I've spent some time with him during the past 6 months, and I've noticed a slight improvement in some functions, very slight. I think we should negotiate as if he has 20 years left. All three men nodded, quick to agree. It's obvious that his parents do not earn a lot of money. They live in a small, cheap apartment with two older daughters. The family needs a home with plenty of space and a bedroom outfitted for Tuya's special needs. Nothing elaborate. These are simple people, but they have dreams. At this point, David slid across three copies of Exhibit 2, which were quickly snatched off the table. David took a deep breath and plowed forward. This is our settlement proposal. First, you see the specific damages. Number one covers the expenses I mentioned, plus a part-time nurse at $30,000 a year, plus the mother's lost salary of $25,000 a year because she would like to quit work and stay home with the boy. I've also added the cost of a new car so they can take him to and from rehab on a daily basis. I've rounded it off to $100,000 a year for 20 years, for a total of $2 million. You can buy an annuity at today's rates for $1.4 million. Rehab is a gray area because I'm not sure how long it would continue. As of today, it runs about $50,000 a year. Assuming 20 years, the annuity will cost you $700,000. Next is the issue of a new home in a nice neighborhood with good schools, $500,000. The next item deals with the Lakeshore Children's Hospital. Their care saved his life and was free, at least to the family, but I think the expenses should be paid back. The hospital was reluctant to give me an estimate, but there it is, $600,000. David was at $3.2 million, and none of the three executives had removed a pen from a pocket. There were no frowns, no head shaking, nothing to indicate they thought he'd lost his mind. Moving on to the non-specifics, I've listed the kid's loss of enjoyment of life and the emotional distress of the family. I know these are vague areas, but they are compensable damages under Illinois law. I suggest the sum of $1.8 million. David folded his hands together and waited on a response. No one seemed surprised. "A tidy sum of $5 million, Carl Laporte said. "What about attorney's fees?" Dylan Cotta asked. "Gee, almost forgot about those," David said, and everyone smiled. "My fee is not taken from what the family gets. It's extra. 30% on top of what you're looking at there, or $1.5 million. "That's a nice payday," Dylan said. David almost mentioned the millions each of the three had earned the previous year in salary and stock options, but let it pass. "I would like to think I could keep it all, but that will not be the case." $6.5 million, Carl said as he laid down his copy of the report and stretched his arms. "You guys seem intent on doing what's right," David said. "Plus, you don't want bad publicity, just like you don't want to roll the dice with an unsympathetic jury." "Our image is very important," Carl said. "We don't pollute rivers or make cheap handguns or deny insurance claims or bilk the government on bad contracts. We make toys for kids. It's just that simple. If we get the reputation for harming children, we're dead."
"Can I ask where you found these products?" Dylan asked. David told the story of So Kang purchasing the first set of nasty teeth a year earlier and of his search high and low in Greater Chicago for similar packages. Carl described the company's efforts to track them down, too, and admitted that Sonesta Games had settled two other similar cases within the past 18 months. They were cautiously hopeful that all lead-painted samples had been removed from the market and destroyed, but not certain. They were at war with several factories in China and had moved most of their production to other countries. The purchase of Gunderson Toys had been a costly blunder. Other stories followed, as if both sides needed a break to think about the settlement proposal on the table. After an hour, they asked David to step outside so they could huddle in private. David drank a cup of coffee with his clients, and after 15 minutes, the same assistant asked him to return to the conference room. She closed the door behind him, and David was ready to cut the deal or walk away. When they were situated and poised, Carl Laporte said, "We were prepared to write a check for $5 million and put this matter to rest, David, but you're asking for a lot more than that." "We will not accept $5 million because the case is worth twice that much. Our number is $6.5 million. Take it or leave it. I'll file a lawsuit tomorrow." "A lawsuit will take years. Can your clients afford to wait?" Dylan asked. "Some of our federal judges use this local rule 8319, nicknamed the Rocket Docket, and believe me, it works. I can have this case before a jury in a year. The last case was far more complicated, and it went to trial 10 months after it was filed. Yes, my clients can survive until the jury brings back the verdict." "You didn't win that case, did you?" Carl asked, with his eyebrows arched, as if he knew everything about the Klopek trial. "No, I did not, but I learned a lot. I had a lousy set of facts. This time, I own the facts. By the time the jury hears everything, $6.5 million will seem like a bargain." "We'll offer $5 million.
David swallowed hard, glared at Carl Laporte and said, "You're not hearing me, Carl. It's $6.5 million now or a lot more a year from now. You're turning down $5 million for these poor Burmese immigrants? I just turned it down, and I'm not negotiating. Your company is well insured. The $6.5 million is not coming off your bottom line."
"Maybe, but the insurance premiums are not cheap."
"I'm not haggling, Carl. Deal or no deal." Carl took a deep breath and exchanged looks with Dylan Cott and Wyatt Vitelli. Then he shrugged, smiled, surrendered, and offered a hand.
"A deal."
David grabbed his hand and shook it firmly. "On the condition that this is extremely confidential," Carl said.
"Of course."
Dylan said, I'll get our guys in legal to prepare an agreement.
Not necessary, David said as he reached into his briefcase. He pulled out a file, removed four copies of a document, and passed them around. This is a settlement agreement that covers everything. It's pretty straightforward and includes all manner of language about confidentiality. I work for a tiny law firm, but it has some complicated problems. It's in my best interest to keep this quiet. You had a settlement agreement prepared at $6.5 million, Carl asked.
You got it. Not a penny less. That's what this case is worth.
Dylan said, this settlement has to be approved by the court, right?
Yes.
I've already established a guardianship for the kid. His father is his legal representative. The court must approve the settlement, and over the years it will supervise the money. I'm required to prepare an annual accounting and meet with the judge once a year, but the file can be sealed to ensure secrecy. They reviewed the agreement, then Carl Laporte signed it on behalf of his company. David signed it, then So and Lewin were brought into the room. David explained the terms of the settlement to them, and they signed under his name. Carl apologized again and wished them well. They were shell-shocked, overcome with emotion, and unable to speak. As they were leaving the building, Dylan Cott asked David if he could have a moment to discuss a matter. The Kangs moved on and waited by David's SUV. Dylan deftly slid a white, unmarked envelope into David's hand as he said, "You didn't get this from me, okay?" David placed it inside his coat pocket. "What is it?" "A list of other products, mainly toys with histories of lead poisoning. Most were made in China, but there are some from Mexico, Vietnam, and Pakistan. Made somewhere else, but imported here by U.S. companies."
"I see. And might these companies be your competitors?"
"You got it."
"Thanks.
Good luck."
Chapter 50 Finley and Figg's last firm meeting took place late that afternoon. At David's insistence, they waited until Rochelle was gone. Oscar was exhausted and cranky, a good sign. His girlfriend and driver had been sent away at 3 p.m., and David promised to drive his senior partner home after the meeting.
"This must be important," Wally said as David locked the front door.
"Indeed it is," he said, taking a seat at the table.
"You guys remember that lead poisoning case I mentioned back a few months ago?"
There were vague recollections, but so much had happened since then.
"Well," David said smugly, "there has been an interesting development."
"Do tell," Wally said, already anticipating something pleasant.
David went through a lengthy narrative of his activities on behalf of the Kangs. He placed a set of nasty teeth on the table as he slowly spun his story toward its delightful climax. "This morning, I met with the CEO and other top executives from the company, and we reached a settlement."
By this time, Wally and Oscar were hanging on every word and exchanging nervous glances. When David said the attorney's fees are $1.5 million, both closed their eyes and lowered their heads as if in prayer. David paused as he retrieved copies of a document for each of them.
"This is a proposed partnership agreement for the new law firm of Finley, Figg, and Zink."
Oscar and Wally held the document, but neither looked at its language. They simply gawked at David, both mouths open, both men too stunned to speak. David continued, "An equal partnership, a three-way split of the bottom line with a monthly draw based on net revenue for each month. You guys keep the building in your names. You may want to look at the third paragraph on the second page."
Neither flipped a page.
"Just tell us," Oscar said.
"Okay, there's some pretty clear language about certain activities the new firm will not engage in. It will not pay bribes or referral fees to policemen, tow truck drivers, rescue personnel, or anyone else for case referrals. It will not advertise on bus stop benches, bingo cards, or any other cheap publication. In fact, all advertising must be approved by the marketing committee, which, at least for the first year, will consist solely of me. In other words, fellas, the firm will no longer chase ambulances."
"What's the fun of that?" Wally asked.
David smiled politely but kept going.
"I've heard talk about advertising on billboards and television. That, too, is prohibited.
Before the firm signs up a new client, the three of us must agree to take the case. In summary, the firm will adhere to the highest standards of professional conduct. Any fees in cash will go straight to the books, which will now be kept by a competent CPA. In effect, gentlemen, the new firm will operate like a real law firm.
This agreement is good for 1 year, and if either of you fails to comply with it, then the partnership will dissolve and I'll find work elsewhere. Back to attorney's fees, Wally said. I'm not sure you finished that part of the discussion. If we can agree on the rules of the new partnership, then I suggest we use the fees from the Kang settlement to pay off the bank and clean up the Crayox mess, including the $15,000 in sanctions levied during the trial. That's about $200,000. Rochelle gets a bonus of $100,000. That leaves $1.2 million for the lawyers, which I think we should divide equally.
Wally closed his eyes. Oscar grunted, then slowly got to his feet and walked to the front door, where he looked through the window. Finally, he said, "You don't have to do this, David."
"I agree," Wally said, though without much conviction. "This is your case. We've done nothing."
"I understand," David said, "but I look at it like this. I would never have found this case had I not been here. It's that simple. A year ago, I was working at a job I hated. By chance, I stumbled into this place, met you guys, and then I got lucky and found this case."
"Excellent point," Wally said, and
Oscar was quick to agree. Oscar walked back to the table and slowly settled into his chair. He looked at Wally and said, "What about my divorce?"
"No problem. We have a signed settlement agreement. Your wife is not entitled to any fees earned after she signed it. The divorce will be final in January."
"That's the way I see it," Oscar said.
"Me too," added David.
Things were silent for a long time. Then AC rose from his pillow and began a low growl. The distant whine of an ambulance siren came into range and grew louder. Wally glanced longingly at the window beside Rochelle's desk.
"Don't even think about it," David said. "Sorry. Force of habit," Wally replied.
Oscar began chuckling, and soon, all three were laughing.
Epilogue. Bart Shaw closed his files and dropped his malpractice threats against Finley and Fig. He collected almost $80,000 from Varick for his successful efforts to torment the firm and force it to trial in the Klopek matter. Adam Grand filed an ethics complaint with the State Bar Association, but it eventually fizzled. Five other clients of the non-death variety did the same, with the same results. Nadine Karras made good on her promise not to seek sanctions for the filing of frivolous lawsuits, but Varick mounted an aggressive and sometimes successful campaign in other courts to collect money from plaintiffs' firms. Jerry Alessandros was hit with a huge fine in southern Florida when it became obvious he had no plans to pursue his Crayox litigation. Tuya Kang suffered a series of violent seizures and died 3 days after Christmas in Lakeshore Children's Hospital. David and Helen, along with Wally, Oscar, and Rochelle, attended the small burial service. Also in attendance were Carl Laporte and Dylan Cott, who, with David's help, managed to have a quiet word with So and Lewin. Carl offered his heartfelt condolences and again took full responsibility on behalf of his company. Under the terms of David's settlement agreement, all sums were vested and would be paid as promised. Oscar's divorce became final in late January. By then, he was living with his new girlfriend in a new apartment and had never been happier. Wally remained sober and was even volunteering to help with other lawyers battling addictions. Justin Bardal was sentenced to 1 year in prison for attempting to torch the law office. He appeared in court in a wheelchair and was required by the judge to acknowledge the presence of Oscar, Wally, and David. Bardal had cooperated with the prosecutors for a light sentence. The judge, who had spent the first 20 years of his career practicing law on the streets of southwest Chicago and had a low opinion of thugs who conspired to burn law offices, did not show compassion for Justin's bosses. The owner of Cicero Pipe was sentenced to 5 years in prison, and his construction superintendent got four. David successfully won a dismissal of Bartle's lawsuit against Oscar and the firm. Not surprisingly, the new partnership did not survive. After his heart surgery and divorce, Oscar lost steam and spent fewer hours at the office. He had some money in the bank and was drawing a pension from Social Security, and his housemate made a comfortable living as a masseuse. He had actually met her next door. After 6 months under the new agreement, he began dropping hints about retiring. Wally was still smarting from his Crayox adventure and had lost his zeal to hustle new cases. He, too, had a new girlfriend, a slightly older woman with a nice balance sheet, as he described it. Also, it was painfully obvious, at least to David, that neither partner had the desire nor talent to put together big cases and take them to trial if necessary. He honestly couldn't imagine walking into another courtroom with those two. His radar was on high alert, and he saw the warning signs immediately. He began planning his exit. 11 months after Emma arrived, Helen gave birth to twin boys. That momentous occasion prompted David to plan a new future. He leased office space not far from their home in Lincoln Park, carefully choosing a fourth-floor suite with a view to the south. He could see the magnificent skyline of downtown, with the Trust Tower squarely in the center of it. The view never failed to motivate him. When things were in place, he informed Oscar and Wally that he planned to leave when the agreement expired at the end of 12 months. The parting was difficult and sad, but not unexpected. It prompted Oscar to announce his retirement. Wally seemed relieved, too. He and Oscar decided on the spot to sell the building and close shop. By the time all three shook hands and wished each other good luck, Wally was planning a getaway to Alaska. David got the dog, and he also got Rochelle, though the two had been in secret talks for a month. He would never consider hiring her away from the firm, but suddenly she was a free agent. With a higher salary and more benefits, she was given the title of office manager and happily moved into the new digs of David E. Zink, attorney at law. The new firm specialized in product liability law. When David settled two more lead poisoning cases, it was clear to him and Rochelle and their expanding staff that the practice was about to become quite lucrative. Most of his work was in federal court, and as business boomed, he found himself downtown more and more. When possible, he stopped by Abner's for a laugh and a quick lunch, a sandwich and a diet soda. On two occasions, he had a Pearl Harbor with Miss Spence, who, though pushing 97, still knocked back three of the syrupy concoctions every day. David could choke down only one, and afterward, he took the train back to the office and enjoyed a nap on his new sofa. This is Dennis Boutsakaris. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Litigators by John Grisham. This program was directed by Kevin Thompson. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2011 by Belfry Holdings, Inc. Production copyright 2011, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.